George, since I didn't ask you to lead another song, and I'm ready and you have your computer in your lap, we're not going to have another song. We'll just go straight ahead. Is that what you planned? Good. We're on the same page here. Mine says page one. I'm just going to start right there, if that's all right with you. I do want to thank all of you, though, for the feast reports. We do really appreciate being able to share the different sites and the different flavors of the local feast sites. It's remarkable how different they can be and yet all be the same. And we have traveled in various parts of the world for the Feast of Tabernacles, all the way from here to South Africa and New Zealand and Australia and various places, the Philippines. It's been, no, not the Philippines for the feast, Philippines for other things. But at any rate, we have traveled to many feast sites around the world, and it's always exciting and interesting to see that no matter where you are and what language they speak, you are at the feast, and you can tell that you're at the feast, and everybody is excited and thankful for the truth and thankful for the knowledge of God's plan. And in spite of the different cultures, the different languages, the different even musical styles, once they get into special music, they sing the hymns all the same pretty much, but you get into special music, it's quite different. But you know you're at God's feast, and that's a wonderful thing. And I appreciate those of you who spoke that last week and this being able to give us a little bit of that flavor. We had planned in both last week and this a combination of reports and split sermons, because we never can quite anticipate how long the feast reports are going to be. It turned out both last week and this week they were shorter than we anticipated. Nevertheless, we planned a split sermon. I shouldn't tell you that, because then I'll end up sounding like it's a full sermon. But at any rate, we did plan both last week and this to split, and so that's the intent today. Last week, we talked about looking ahead to next year's Feast of Tabernacles and how we can begin planning for it now and preparing for it now. Because the best time to think about that is when it's on your mind, when you've just come home from the feast and you've either had a very successful feast or you've had a feast with a few problems that you think you can fix if you prepare ahead of time and look forward to next year. In Fiery's case, we can't fix the wallet, so we're not sure exactly how we're going to help him get to Hawaii in 2015. I got a feeling it's going to come out of Leslie's grocery budget, but we'll see how that works. But we do want to plan ahead and try to plan. But today, I want to do something in reverse. I want us to look back at the feast we just had, as Mr. Franks was talking about in his letter. I want to look back at the feast we just had and consider where that can take us in the coming year. What do I mean, where it can take us? I don't mean can it take us to Fiji or Hawaii or Pigeon Forge. I mean, where can it take us spiritually? Can we look back on this feast and use it as a launching pad for growth, both personally and congregationally? Those of you who like a title, I titled this The Feast as Launching Pad for Growth. The Feast as Launching Pad for Growth. I'm sure we all understand that God did not design the feast, or any of his holy days for that matter, as an end in itself. These days are for the purpose of better understanding God, better understanding God's plan, better understanding God's relationship with us, better understanding what God is doing with all of mankind and what the future holds for them. But the days don't just impart knowledge for the sake of knowledge. In other words, we could go to the feast and say, we learned a lot, but what we learned is only as valuable as what we do with it. Mr. Armstrong used to say, knowledge is of no value unless you put it to use. So you can learn a great deal, and many people have in their lives, about any number of insignificant things, but they can't use it. And so that knowledge is of no great value. You might think back on the Pharisees and scribes, for that matter. They had a lot of knowledge. They often knew every detail of certain parts of the scriptures, but they didn't know how to use them. They didn't know how to apply them. They didn't know how to live, and they didn't understand even that Jesus Christ was the Messiah. Then we have the warning, if we want to look at the negative side for a moment, of the Apostle James, who tells us, to him that knows to do good and does it not, to him it is sin. All right, so to him that knows to do, what is that, 4:17, I think. To him that knows to do good and does it not, to him it is sin. So if we learned a good bit, in fact, maybe the more we learn, the more responsible we are for what we do with it, because otherwise we have knowledge of what's right and wrong, but we may not be using it. Valuable knowledge can come back and bite us if we don't follow through on it. So we want to make sure that we don't just jettison the feast without looking at where we want to go as a result. So what about what we were able to learn at the feast? And remember, we learn not just through academic information. No doubt we had some powerful sermons. No doubt we had some doctrinal explanations. We had some good information given to us. But we learned also through a wealth of experience, didn't we? We learned through a whole range of experiences that God gives us at the feast for that very purpose. We probably learned a new doctrinal detail or two from somebody. Somebody got up and gave a sermon in a way that we hadn't heard before, or explained something a little more clearly than we might have heard it before. And so we might have come home thinking, well, you know, I never quite understood that before. I actually had a couple, three people tell me that in Park City after I spoke on the morning of the last great day about the second resurrection, about the judgment of all that have ever lived. There were people there who did not know that truth, or did not understand it fully, or did not understand how it would work. And so they came, and it's always encouraging to hear people say, thank you, I never really understood that before, and it was good to hear that explanation. That's always gratifying. Now, for the most part, as a minister at the feast, you know you're speaking to a vast number of people who know everything you know. All you're trying to do is remind them of it or help them to think about it from a little different point of view. But for the most part, we all know those doctrinal truths. And you tend to speak from the standpoint of helping people to think them through and apply them. And when somebody comes and says, I didn't even know that, and I appreciated the way you explained it, well, that's of course, exciting. But you hope that that's not all that happened in that sermon, but that other people learned something as well. So we learned a doctrinal point or two, probably. But we may have also learned how to more deeply empathize with a brother in need, somebody who was sick, somebody who was hurt. In Park City, we had a couple of guys go down the hill on a bike, and they went down the hill off of the bike. And one of them ended up in the hospital, and the first day they announced it, he had 7 broken ribs, and 2 days later they told us he had 9 broken ribs. Can't break too many more than that. So we all learn to be thoughtful of that person and to pray for that person and to ask the family members and so forth day by day how he was doing and what his circumstances were. And you learn to think about how would I feel if I were here at the feast and got hurt so badly that I'm laid up in the hospital while everybody else is having a good time. And in fact, I got hurt having a good time. And you learn to empathize with those situations. Some of us may have learned, sometimes for the first time, how good it feels to have peace in our lives day by day. Some people don't have peace day by day. They have difficulties in their home. They have difficulties in their marriage, difficulties with their children, maybe difficulties with their jobs, maybe difficulties with their landlord, any number of things that can be going on in life that just keep us upset. And you go off to the feast, and if we do it the way God instructs us to do it, we basically leave everything behind. Now, it's fine, perfectly fine to pray that God will protect and keep your property, your household, your goods, whatever, even part of the family you may have to leave behind in some cases. It's fine to pray for those things, but basically we go away and we say, I'm going in faith to serve God and to keep the feast, and whatever happens behind is not my concern. You go to the feast, and to be able to have peace day in and day out. Now, I lived in a household with 8 of us, and it's remarkable to be able to say we had peace every day. We had no squabbles. We had no conflicts. We had no arguments. We had some exciting in-depth discussions of some of the doctrinal material or some of the activities of the feast, but we had no conflict. We had no squabbles. We had no difficulties. We didn't have any difficulties even with, the people we were renting from or from the people we interacted with out in the public, in a restaurant or in transportation situations. We didn't have any problems. It was peaceful. And I hope that every one of us had that kind of a feast. But I sometimes wonder if we did and if we're even able to. Sometimes we take our troubles with us. Sometimes we take our troubles with us. And I don't mean the person who rode with you, though that could have been your trouble. But we take along whatever is bugging us. We take along whatever is on our minds. And sometimes it takes days to get rid of it before we actually can come down to earth and have a good feast. And that's the way it works with the mind and the body. I remember many years ago, 40 years ago almost, one of the senior executives in Pasadena writing to the ministry, and he said, Mr. Armstrong has approved me taking a three-week vacation. And he said, I have never taken a three-week vacation, but he said, I have always found that a two-week vacation, I never quite get to the point where I'm relaxed and have washed out all of the troubles that are in my brain when I get to vacation. And I am pretty stressed out, and I'm really looking forward to 3 weeks of vacation. He later wrote and said, sure enough, it took about 16 or 17 days before I was able to relax and really enjoy my vacation. Now, we don't have that many when you go to the feast. For the most part, you have 8 or 10 days. And it helps to get relaxed right away. And the best way to do that is to go in faith that everything's going to be fine and put it behind you. And again, if you're taking your troubles with you, to try to hang those up at the door and say, I'm not going to deal with this issue while I'm here. Now, there are times to simply say when you go to the feast, okay, so I've got a problem I'm going to have to address as soon as I get back. And many of us had those. I had some of those. Things we're going to have to address as soon as I get back. And you're tempted to be thinking about it day by day during the feast. And the fact is, the best thing to do is to say, look, I can't do anything about it. Besides that, I don't want to do anything about it. I want to be at the feast. I want to be serving God. I want to be serving God's people. I want to be interacting with my family. I want to be doing the things I'm supposed to do at the feast. So I'm going to take this and hang it right up here on this nail and ignore it for the entire time that I'm here until I get back. And I hope you were able to do that. I was able to do that on the things that I have to deal with that are sometimes difficult and challenging, whether they're my personal things or whether they're congregational things, it doesn't matter. The things that can't be dealt with and don't need to be dealt with during the feast, you put up on the nail and you leave them. And it makes the feast go a great deal better. And I hope that we did that. I hope that we experienced true peace in our lives day by day. And the more of the feast that we had that, the better. Some of us may have learned how comfortable and pleasant it is just to have good quality and great tasting food available in reasonable quantities during the feast. Now, that may or may not apply to anybody in this congregation, but certainly it applies to people in various parts of the world and various parts of the United States. People come to the feast, and it's one of the few times that they feel like they actually can eat whatever they want, that they can eat a good meal. Maybe it's not the special steak that some can afford. For some people, it's just a good solid meal and having it three times a day, perhaps. So we can learn different things while we're at the feast, but that all comes into the lesson of why we're at the feast and looking to God to show us that His law is going to finally be applied throughout the world, and the knowledge of God's way is going to be like the waters cover the sea and the earth. And man is going to profit from it, and we're going to see tremendous things. We might have even learned for the first time how to just have good, clean fun that doesn't hurt tomorrow. Now, sometimes good, clean fun can help to hurt tomorrow if you fall down off your bicycle going down a mountain, just to use the same example. We always have people who get hurt at the feast. That isn't because they're doing something that's wrong or doing something that's sinful, but just because we're human beings and we're subject to those things. So when I say that, I simply say it's sometimes people have had lives that never experienced good, clean fun without the hangover or whatever it is. And I use the hangover not in the alcohol sense, but just in the aftermath of the penalty that comes from some of the things that we go through in life. And to go to the feast and be able to enjoy good, clean fun that doesn't hurt tomorrow, for some people, is a very special lesson. to find out that you really can have a good time. Sometimes it's just sitting with people talking for hours, day after day. Well, no doubt you could add many other things to that rather hastily expressed list. You probably learned lots of different things through your feast experiences, and each of us probably learned different things from the others. That's why it's kind of fun to hear the feast reports, one of the reasons. But we have all, if we kept the feast properly, we have all been enriched by the Feast of Tabernacles. We've been enriched by being in the presence of God for 8 days, by being in the presence of God's people for 8 days, by learning from the Scriptures, having the Scriptures read to us, maybe expounded to us, taught to us in various ways, even if they weren't the greatest sermons, as we heard in one of the reports. You know, okay, you still learn some things. You pick up some things. You hear a good sermon here, a sermon that doesn't ring, you know, your bell the next day. You still learn something every day of the feast, and you come away with lessons that you can use. So God gives us some principles about what we do with that. Now, let's go back to Psalm 77. I'm going to read two or three of the different excerpts from the Psalms here, but 77. My question is, what do we do now? We've been to the feast, we've kept the feast, we've had our fun, we've had our good times, we've learned some spiritual lessons, we've learned probably some physical lessons, and now what do we do? In Psalm 77, let me break into this, verse 11, I will remember the works of the Eternal. That's where I think we should start. Let's remember the works of the Eternal, especially those that we experienced during the feast, and the fact that God commanded the feast in the first place. We were only there because God commanded us to be there. God knew what we needed, and God commanded us to keep his feast. But God provided for us to keep his feast, as we talked about last week. God blessed us. God opened doors. God opened our mind to understand the feast. This statement is not about the feast. I'm simply taking the principle from here that says, remember the works of the Eternal. Surely I will remember your wonders of old. And we can't really keep the Feast of Tabernacles without remembering the other holy days. And we can't remember the other holy days without realizing God had to send Jesus Christ to pay the penalty for our sins. We can't keep the feast without remembering that God is going to send Jesus Christ again as King of Kings. In other words, we should pull it all together, brethren, not let the feast just be an isolated experience or a physical experience that happened to be fun or that happened to be enjoyable or that happened to be new and exciting, but rather a meaningful chapter in our lives. And many of us have kept the feast for a very long time. I think Mr. Larry Neff was our usual senior person at the feast, even though he's younger than I. Larry Neff has kept the feast for, this is 62nd, I believe he said, 61 or 2, I believe it was 2. 62 years, which is pretty much his whole life, or most of his life. He was a very young boy when he started keeping the feast. But we have many people who've kept the feast 50 or 60 years. So it's not just how many times we've kept them. It's what we do with what we got from those feasts and what we remember out of those feasts, how we use it. I will surely remember your wonders of old. I will also meditate on all your work and talk of your deeds. One of the great things that happens at the Feast of Tabernacles is you meet people and you get acquainted. And you start discussing your lives, and you discuss your various experiences, and often it comes around to how you were called and what miracles God might have done in your life to bring you to the truth. And you begin to actually praise and glorify God, in a sense, unintentionally. That is, all of a sudden you realize, hey, we're talking about the greatness and the power of God to bring us to the truth and to give us what he has given us. Talk of your deeds. Your way, O God, is in the sanctuary. Yeah, his way is in the church. His way is in the temple. His way is in the feast. His way is where we come before him to worship him. Your way, O God, is in the sanctuary. Who is so great a God as our God? You are the God who does wonders. You have declared your strength among the peoples. You have, with your arm, redeemed your people. you and I have been redeemed. We've been bought back from the captivity that we were in to Satan, the devil, the god of this world. And when we keep the Feast of Tabernacles, we should be remembering that on a regular basis and talking about it and sharing the tremendous wonders of our experience. I think I mentioned last week that we were traveling with the Hendrons, and we have known each other well and spent lots of time together for many, many 40 years. And we sat down one evening and got to discussing some things that we had never discussed before about our personal pasts, and learned things about each other's experiences that we didn't know. And that was fascinating to us, because we thought we'd turned over every stone that might have existed in our 40 years, but we hadn't. And it was inspiring to learn some of the things that Jack and Mary had gone through that we hadn't even really focused on in all of our friendship time with them. And that can happen in a feast environment. Is this expression in the psalm the effect the feast had on us? Did we remember? Do we talk about it? Do we share it? Do we thank God for it? Do we acknowledge that God declared his strength among the people and that God has redeemed his people? Or are we maybe like the Israelites in Psalm 106, verse 7. Psalm 106, verse 7 gives us an alternative, a way to approach the feast and the wonderful experiences we've had, or whatever experiences we might have counted, because some of us probably won't count them as wonderful. Psalm 106, verse 7, our fathers in Egypt did not understand your wonders. They did not remember the multitude of your mercies, but rebelled by the sea, the Red Sea. We're always amazed when we go back and read those accounts, aren't we? And we read them sometimes in preparation for the Passover and Days of Unleavened Bread and even sermons. We read about what Israel did and we say, how could they have done that? Of course, we say the same thing about Adam and Eve. How could they have done that? Because human beings are human beings, and we're no different. We're different only in the sense that we have access to God's Spirit, and we can be different if we choose to. But if we go the way of nature, if we are like the dead fish floating downstream instead of swimming against it, we're going to be in this condition. They rebelled at the sea because they did not remember his wonders. They didn't understand them. They had already witnessed tremendous miracles that God had performed in their lives and in Egypt before they arrived at the Red Sea. But they rebelled against God. We don't want to do that. We don't want to do that. And yet, brethren, we're not ignorant of Satan's devices, are we? I first thought about planning a sermon today to talk about being aware of the potential for Satan to come right along after the feast and tempt us. I chose not to give that sermon, but I do want to bring up that point, that Satan the devil is always lurking about, waiting for an opportunity to trip us up. And if he can do it in the context of making us feel bad about something God wants us to feel good about, then it's just another replay of "You shall not surely die." Satan the devil would like to use something from God's feast to offend us. He would like for us to feel bad about something we ought to feel good about. Now, I'm not saying we should deceive ourselves or compromise with something we think was bad. There probably could have been, as Mr. Frank said, bad things happened. Okay. And sometimes it's people do bad things. We have had to sometimes send people home from the Feast of Tabernacles because they do bad things. So I'm not suggesting that we just say, oh, it was a wonderful feast, and, you know, I didn't really mind that guy hitting me in the nose, and, you know, that woman that cursed me out, it was no big deal. No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying don't let Satan the devil take something that should be good and that probably was good and allow it to eat away at us until it offends us, because he would like to insert into our thinking his negative view of everything. His attitude that it can't possibly be good. It can't possibly work out. He would certainly like for us to face some kind of discouragement as soon as we come home from the feast. Now, one of the big discouragements that people have faced in the past, and I haven't heard anybody in this congregation this year, and I've been the victim on at least three occasions, when you come home from a holy day or the feast and your boss says, you don't work here anymore. That can be discouraging because you're thinking, well, wait, I went and kept the feast, I obeyed God, how come I'm out of my ear? Well, because God didn't guarantee you that you're going to not be put in that situation. In fact, there are times when we simply have to stand up and prove that we're going to do it regardless of what Satan and his society does to us. But he would like for us to face discouragement and begin to forget what we just experienced. You know, if Satan can distract us immediately after the feast so that we begin to think about all the problems we have or all the things that have gone wrong or get all discouraged and down and out immediately after the feast, then we've lost the value of the feast. It was only 8 days long when it should last us a whole year. So we have to be careful not to let Satan the devil discourage us and make us say, oh, well, we shouldn't have gone, or we haven't been blessed the way we should have been, or same old problems are still here when we get home. Well, in some cases, the same old problems are still here when we get home. We knew they were going to be, and like I said, we should have hung them on the nail and left them there and asked God to help us to deal with them when we start over again. Because the feast doesn't do away with all of our problems, but we don't want our problems to do away with the feast and to leave us without that memory and that appreciation for what God has done. We don't want to lose sight of what the feast taught us. The plan of God for all of mankind, a plan of salvation, is going to save mankind from himself. Satan would like for us to put the feast behind us and plunge right back into his miserable world and start coping with the problems we have. Except not coping with them would be better in his mind. We don't want to let Satan accomplish that goal. We're not ignorant of his devices. So guard yourselves and guard our minds against what Satan might plant there as we return from the feast and get back into our routines. Remember, part of our defense is to remember what God has done for us and to glorify God in that. God has reminded us through the holy days of his plan, of his power, of what he's done, of the fact that he's the creator. He put us here. He is our God. God has given us all of that to remember. We don't want to walk away and forget it. The very description of the holy days and the process of them shows that God is going to fight our battles for us, even to the death of Jesus Christ and the return of Jesus Christ and the binding of Satan and all those things we have pictured over these past few weeks. God will fight our battles for us. Back to Psalms, Psalm 20 this time. Psalm 20. Just as an aside, it's amazing how little the problem can be to frustrate you and spend way too much time on. And sometimes it's demanded of you. Believe it or not, I am struggling with my retirement fund. You didn't know I had such a thing, did you? Well, we put a little money away in a 403B, which is the nonprofit equivalent of a 401K. But that 403B was sponsored by, at the time, the United Church of God, of which I was an employee. So most of my retirement funds are in an account that is under the United Church of God. Has nothing to do with the church, so don't go wrong here. And nothing to do with the church, either of them. But now I work for a different employer, and I have a different account for that employer into which I'm contributing a small amount of money each paycheck as a savings account for retirement. All I need to do is roll the old account over into the new account. The reason being that I have turned 70 and a half, and when you turn 70 and a half, you have to take a minimum distribution. I don't want to take that minimum distribution for two reasons. I don't want to take the money out of the account, and two, it's going to cost me $1,000 or so in taxes. I don't want to do that. So I want to just roll it over. Well, guess what? In 6 or 8 or 10 conversations with the officials of the Mutual of America, in this case, company who holds the funds, they have told me different things several different times. I get some people tell me, yes, you can do that. You can just roll it all over. Because you're still working, you don't have to take a distribution. You don't have to pay any taxes. You don't have to do that until you retire. Quit working. Great. Well, I get right down to it. Yesterday, I'm talking to the supervisor in Dallas, and she says, no, you have to take a distribution before I can roll this over. And I say, no, your people told me I don't have to. Yeah, well, you do. So later, we're at the bank, and we use the notary at the bank to sign the document that my wife has to agree that I'm going to do this, because we had to have it notarized. So we're notarizing the document. And so I said to the notary, who was a banker, I said, do you have any knowledge of retirement plans? And sure. I said, do I have to take this distribution? She said, yes, because you're already 70 and a half. And I said, no, it's the calendar year in which you're 70 and a half, et cetera. I said, I've been told I don't have to. She said, well, but you do. And then I said, but I'm taking it from a 403B to a 403B. And she said, oh, it's a 403B to a 403B? You're not putting in an investment account or anything? I said, no, I'm taking it from a 403B to a 403B. She said, then you don't. I said, well, thanks a lot. Now you've confirmed what everybody else has told me. I do, but I don't. Or I don't, but I do. And I still don't know. So I've talked to numerous people, and I will have to find the right person to say what I want him to say and then say, let's do it right now. If I can do that, I'll be in good shape. Anyway, it's a little bitty thing, and it's a thing that shouldn't take a lot of my time and energy, but it has to be done. If it isn't, you know what the government does? Oh, we did have a government, didn't we? At one time, we had a government. We had a government at one time. If I'm supposed to take the distribution and I don't take it, the government takes 50% of it. So my little tax might be worth it. So you got to get it right. If you don't get it right, it's just a mess. And again, it's no big deal, but it's one of those things that just eats on you because you can't get anybody to nail it down and get it right. And I simply don't know the answer. But I will get the answer, probably with help from my good friends in McNeely and McNeely. Where did I go? Psalm 20, verse 1. May the Eternal answer you in the day of trouble. See, if we fight our battles and we ask God to help, Satan cannot get us down and discourage us this way. God is still working in our lives. God is on our side. May the Eternal answer you in the day of trouble. May the name of the God of Jacob defend you. May he send you help from the sanctuary. Remember, we saw God's way is in the sanctuary. And strengthen you out of Zion. May he remember all your offerings and accept your burnt sacrifice, Selah. May he grant you according to your heart's desire and fulfill all your purpose. We will rejoice in your salvation. In the name of our God, we will set up our banners. May the Eternal fulfill all your petitions. Now I know that the Eternal saves his anointed. He will answer him from his holy heaven with the saving strength of his right hand. This is about David. This is about Christ. This is about you and me. He will save him with the saving strength of his right hand. Some trust in chariots and some in horses, armies, or government agents. Some trust in chariots and some in horses, but we will remember the name of the Eternal, our God. They have bowed down and fallen, but we have risen and stand upright. Save, Eternal, may the King answer us when we call. Pretty comforting to know that the King is standing by, that he's waiting for our call, that he's waiting for us to say, we want to ask you for some help in this situation that we have on our hands. In Philippians chapter 1, there's a little scripture that I have spent a lot of time meditating on over the years. I appreciate it deeply and love the encouragement that comes from it. Philippians chapter 1, verse 6, breaking into Paul's thought where he's talking about God working with us. In verse 6, it says, being confident of this very thing, that he who has begun a good work in you will complete it until the day of Jesus Christ. Christ is going to carry it out. He has begun a good work in us. He's not going to fail. He's not going to quit. He's not going to say, okay, you kept the feast and you've come home, but I'm going to go about doing something else now. I've forgotten about you. No, God knows who we are. He sees us. He knows us. He understands us. He recognizes us, recognizes our heart. He sees us. He wants to work in us and through us. But we have to do our part. As we look back on the feast and analyze the things that we learned, some of us, we have some experiences in common. We all kept the feast the same way in one sense, and yet in some ways they're very different. So you have to ask, what made an impression on you? What did you actually learn? What did you actually come away with? Maybe it's a general principle, a broad answer to something, or maybe it's something very specific that you learned. It could have been something new and interesting that you'd never heard before. Or it could have simply been the light going on that said, hey, you know, I've heard this 100 times, but I never fully understood it before. Maybe it was how something was said. Maybe it was an example that somebody used in a sermon. Maybe it was an example in life of some Christian behaving the way Christians should behave. And you said, wow, that's good. Maybe it was the whole context of being among God's people and worshiping God and saying, wow, how good and how pleasant it is to dwell together with brethren in unity. All of these things affect us. But how can we use this knowledge? How can you share it with somebody who needs it? Will it motivate us to change the way we think or the way we function or the way we do certain things in our lives? Will it help us to better understand others? And will we take action on that understanding? You see, we need to learn what we learned and feel it and use it. We think about the millennium, which is what that first 7 days of the feast pictures, the 1,000-year reign of Jesus Christ. Can we better taste it and understand it and know what it is now than we did before we went to this feast? Do we have a better picture and a better idea of what God is doing? Does it provoke us to do as the Apostle Paul said, you know, back in 1 Timothy 4:8, when he said, there's a crown of righteousness laid up for me, which the Eternal will give me at the last day. And also to all those who have loved his appearing. Did the holy days, the Feast of Trumpets, the Day of Atonement, the Feast of Tabernacles, the last great day, did they make us that much more able to love his appearing? Do we deeply love the appearing of Jesus Christ? Do we look forward to his coming? Because we can tend to get involved in our world and think it's kind of far off and distant and not something we have a personal interaction with. But that's the most personal interaction we can have. It's when this vile body is changed in a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, and we become the spirit-born children of God. So do we see that in the millennium? Do we see it not as just an extension of this life where it might be a little more peaceful? You know, do we see the millennium like the feast? Let me tell you, the millennium isn't going to be anything like the feast. Because the feast is human in the sense that we are doing our best to emulate Christ, but we're all physical human beings with our own human nature and our own problems and troubles, with the Holy Spirit working with us to mold us and shape us. But we live in an environment that is surrounded. When you walk out of the door of that sanctuary at the feast, you're once again surrounded with society. You go eat in a nice restaurant, you're surrounded by society. You turn on your car radio, you're surrounded by society. The millennium isn't going to be anything like the feast. The millennium is going to be a whole new world where everything's changed and where everything's wonderful as God puts his laws in place. I'm not saying it's going to be that way on day one or even year five. It's going to take some time for the millennial peace and prosperity and joy to overtake the world. But do we see it and understand it and want it more now because we kept this feast? What about the wonders of the last great day? You know, we're almost alone in the world in understanding anything about the resurrection of those who are dead. Nobody believes that the billions of people who are dead in their graves are going to come to life again. But it's what God says, and it's what we believe, and it's comforting. And it's a wonderful truth that our ancestors, our teachers, our close friends, relatives maybe that we've lost to death in accident or sickness or whatever, sometimes older, sometimes young, that all those individuals that are dead without the knowledge of God's plan are going to have that knowledge, that they're going to have an opportunity to choose salvation. That's a wonderful truth. Can we come away from the feast and look at all these things and say, wow, what a God we serve. What a tremendous and wonderful God we serve. Are we better equipped in that sense to give answers for the hope that lies in us in meekness and fear? I hope that we are, and I think that we probably are. We have to be able to look back at the feast and say, it was a wonderful feast, as we've heard in his reports, as we've talked to each other, as we've shown our pictures and talked about the various things, and we will for weeks and months to come, probably. We have to be able to do that, but we also have to say, this gives us something to go on. As we enter the long winter season, as it were, until the holy days come again in the spring, it can be easy to get sidetracked and to get discouraged, maybe by health problems, by financial problems, by personal offenses between individuals within the church, even by the church itself, if the church somehow fails to meet our needs or expectations. We can get discouraged, we can get offended, and we can let that discourage us and drive us to a place of desperation that Satan the devil would like for us to be. But please do not give place to the devil. Do not allow that to happen. Remember the lessons of the fall holy days. Remember the lessons of the Feast of Tabernacles and the last great day. And continue to rejoice in that knowledge and use that knowledge day by day to grow closer to God and to look forward to the fulfillment of God's plan and purpose for you and me. It's a wonderful plan. Let's close with Luke chapter 12. Luke chapter 12. Verse 31 reminds us of our goal and our purpose and what we were doing at the feast. Verse 31 says, "But seek the kingdom of God, and all these things shall be added to you," talking about our physical needs. But then verse 32, Jesus himself says, "Do not fear, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom." It is God's good pleasure to give us the kingdom. He gave us the feast to look forward to and picture that kingdom. And he will deliver in his own time, on schedule, as he sees fit. And you and I have a crown laid up waiting for that day. I hope that we love the appearing of Jesus Christ and that we love the feast that he's provided for us and that we can look forward to receiving finally, that sonship in his family and a place in the kingdom of God.